This is the podcast for Monday, February 6th, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. And I was just exhorting the student class here to speak loudly if they want to participate, particularly students sitting in the back of the class. Okay. So today we're going to talk about Hume. And I think a good way of thinking about David Hume is Berkeley without God. So, if you follow the empiricists, you can think about Locke as a kind of a moderate empiricist. He's sort of like the Romney of empiricism. Then you have Berkeley, and he's more of a pretty strong empiricist, maybe like a Santorum. And then you have Hume, who's sort of like the Ron Paul or something. The Ron Paul, the radical. So, and the person who says principles matter. And when you have a principle, you either follow it or you don't. And you don't say, well, the principle, it kind of applies here, but it doesn't apply here. And so I'm just going to like pick and choose which places to apply my principle. So, if you think about like the sort of, following my analogy here, conservatism, and suppose you characterize this as the idea of limited constitutional government. And you can see how Romney, he's like, well, yeah, he talked about limited constitutional government. He vetoed a bunch of laws in Massachusetts, but he also created a government healthcare system in the state of Massachusetts. You know, and if you're a small government person, blowing up the state government and having it take over medical care is not something a small government person could do. But you know, he has some conservative ideas. He's like a businessman. He worked at resurrecting companies and getting them out of bankruptcy and making them profitable again. He kind of sort of believes in capitalism, but you know, with a bunch of qualifiers. You look at Santorum, who's much more of a conservative. But then Santorum's got all this social conservative thing. So he says, okay, I believe in strict constitutional government, but I think you know the government should be the morality police, and I think that we should have a federal law that says that gay people can't get married, and just some of his policies, I suppose you might say, about abortion, about continuing the drug war. And so those are areas where he doesn't believe in limited government. He thinks government should tell you what you can smoke, what you can drink. He still believes in regulation of gambling, prostitution, right? Which are all, you know, individual choices people make. Not all of them good, right? Nobody, even people who snort cocaine and shoot heroin don't think it's good for them, right? So he says, oh, limited government, you know. So Romney, you know, might is sort of moderate. Santorum is kind of a strong conservative, and then the Ron Paul, people use the word extreme, or you might use this other word, consistent, and he believes in principle. And a lot of the concessions here, I think, of these two guys in particular, where they sort of compromise their principles, it's to political realities. And the concessions of the empiricists here would be to what then? What if we follow my analogy here? What do the empiricists say? Well, okay, empiricism is generally true, but if you follow it too far, what do you end up with? Or what's the negative consequence if you're too much of an empiricist?
Nothing exists.
Yeah, well, maybe not nothing exists, but only ideas exist or only minds exist. You end up with these weird counterintuitive or non-common sense conclusions, where you can't know anything. The only thing that exists are our minds and ideas. You can't know there's a material world. And you get to Hume, there's no such thing as minds. There's no such thing as there's no such thing as cause and effect. The only thing, according to Hume, that you can really know is that you have certain experiences, and certain experiences are followed by other certain experiences, and that's pretty much it. And that's a very skeptical place to end up with. So Locke is what you might call more common sense. Barclay seems to be the friend of common sense, but come on. So claims common sense. Just like Santorum claims to be for liberty of government, and then he says, "Oh, but gay people can't get married, and people that smoke dope should be thrown into jail, and and that the government should be the protector of public morality, and so on and so forth," which are again aren't limited government. He's like, limited government, except in these issues, the sort of social, conservative, legislating, religion, morality issues that he believes in. So, claims common sense, he has many views, he claims to be the friend of common sense, but not really. So, on the exam, I might ask you something like, what does Barclay say about common sense? And you should remember, Barclay claims to be common sense, because he says, "I think that knowledge is all about what you can see, touch, taste, smell, and hear. And what could be more common sense than that? What you see, there's a table in front of you, what you see is the real table. The real table is the sensible table, the collection of sense data." Somebody like Locke has this crazy theory of the material world or material substratum, some philosophical abstraction, which is more real than what you can lay your hands on, but you can never touch it, you can never see it, you can never taste it, you can never smell it. It's sort of hiding beneath all your sensations. And he says, that's how close to common sense is that? That's nutty, right? I'm Mr. Common Sense. Locke is one of these philosophers trying to get you to buy into their kooky theory. But really, when you ask people about whether they think that there's a world independent of their sensations, most people will say yes. Going back to our early relativism discussion, most people will say, there is a real world out there. It's different than what's in my mind. And things exist whether people are aware of them or not. Now, I know it's very fashionable for people to quote experiments in quantum physics and say, the observer determines what's real. But if you look at the experiments themselves, that's not what they really say. People are notoriously misinterpret them, and then you get these new age kooks that try to draw conclusions that the experimenters themselves aren't drawing. So the idea that there's a world apart from our perception of it, I think, is a common sense logical posit that's sort of the foundation of knowledge. Ayn Rand, actually, we were talking about Ayn Rand before class started, and Ayn Rand has this statement, and I think she starts out with these sort of fundamental axioms or starting places for knowledge, and one is that A equals A, the law of identity. But she puts it another way in the metaphysical realm. She says, existence exists, and that's just this idea that there is a mind-independent reality, and that is what exists. And what exists does not depend on what's in your mind. You're aware of existence through your mind, but your mind does not determine what that reality is. So Barclay, again, claims to be common sense, but really his views are anti-common sense, in that he claims X exists. X is perceived.
by some mind, which I think is not common sense.
So when he counts it a certain way, is that I just believe the empirical world, you think, okay, that sounds common sense. But when he says, oh, that's all there is to the world, that if no one were sensing something, then it wouldn't exist, then that's not common sense. By the way, what would Berkeley say about the books in my study when I turn out the light and leave the room? What would happen to them? All right, a little louder, please. I can't hear you even from here.
Berkeley's perception of it would be that they stay there because something, a godlike force, is still perceiving them, even though a human being is not perceiving them.
Yeah, Berkeley would actually say God, not like a godlike force kind of hedges it, but he would say God's perceiving the books. So even if no human person is perceiving the books, God always perceives all. And so this gives, you know, the world stability, and that God is always perceiving all the ideas. And so that's why the books in your study don't pop out of existence when you leave, even though you're not looking at them, because God's looking at them. And so this comes, there's that poem in the end of the section there by Ronald Knox. Can I borrow somebody's book for a second? I can get a chance to get mine before class.
Ended class early because of the committee.
Oops, that's you. It's on page 128. There once was a man who said, God must think it exceedingly odd if he finds that this tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. Reply. Dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I'm always about in the quad, and that's why the tree continues to be since observed by yours faithfully, God. So the point there is that even when no human person is in the quad looking at the tree, does the tree just disappear? And Berkeley says no, because God always perceives his creation, and so that's what gives it a sort of a stability, just like the material world is supposed to have independent existence. God gives the world not independent existence, but dependent existence. So this has a consequence that the world still depends on God for its existence. Some interpretations of God say that even the material world depends on God from moment to moment for its existence. I think Descartes says that, right? In one of his proofs for God's existence, he says that God is necessary to explain the existence of a thing from one moment to the next. So that's Berkeley's, you know, Berkeley's trying to again show that he's common sense, because he says, look, my view doesn't say things pop out of existence when you turn your head. It just means that when you're not looking at them, God's keeping them in existence. So that maintains this definition that X is perceived means, or X exists means X is perceived by some mind. So even if you're not perceiving it, God's perceiving it. And that's why if you turn on the light again, your books are still there. Okay, but still kind of not really common sense. And then Hume, a very anti-common sense. And Hume is sometimes called the father of logical positivism. Sometimes also called verificationism. Logical positivism or verificationism. And that's just the idea that unless you can prove something with reference to some set of actual or possible sense impressions, it doesn't exist. And so, the logical positivist would say love, justice, virtue, they don't exist. Or they'll say, well, what it really is is virtue is just sort of a set of behaviors, or justice is, or they might say love is a chemical reaction in your brain. But the idea of these sort of abstract ideals, they would say that if you, again, if you can't prove it experimentally in a lab, if you can't prove it with regard to some set of sense impressions, get rid of it. It's nonsense. And of course, God doesn't fare very well in this equation. And there's a place in Hume where he says, you know, pick up, he says, convinced of these principles, meaning the principles of empiricism, what havoc must we wreak? He says, when you go into the library, if you pick up a book, ask yourself, is it a priori reasoning? Is it about mathematics or logic? And he says, no. And he says, well, is it about science? Is it about astronomy or biology or some empirical science? No. And then he says, consign it to the flames then, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. And now Hume isn't literally saying go out and burn down the libraries or burn all the books on theology, but his point is that if you're an empiricist, you got to stop tolerating all this nonsense of stuff that people like Descartes that spin all these theories that are supposedly based on a priori principles, but it's really a bunch of nonsense. And unless it's logic or mathematics or it's science, you're just fooling yourself if you believe in it. So Hume's a pretty strong skeptic. So again, you can think about Hume as Berkeley without God, and Hume appropriates a lot of Berkeley's arguments in arguing against Locke. So he sort of picks up all of Berkeley's arguments, but then takes them one step further and gets rid of things that are important in Berkeley's philosophy. So there's a little discussion of this in the text. Locke believes in what things? Well, Locke believes in the material world still. And he believes in minds and cause and effect and ideas. So you think about what kinds of things there are. Well, there are minds and ideas, but there's also material cause and effect. There's a material world out there. And I suppose it's a bit like God in here too. These are all things Descartes believes in too. So that's Locke. Which one of these does Berkeley get rid of?
Material world.
Right, he keeps God, he gets rid of the material world. He has cause and effect, but it's a kind of a mental causation. So Berkeley has God, minds, mental causation or cause and effect, and the mental cause and effect is, he calls this willing. Philosophers will sometimes call this intention. So it's just the idea of making a decision. I will for my arm to go up, and my arm goes up. That's not a material arm, and I have a material brain, but he says, you form the intention to do something, and then God sends you the ideas that fulfill that intention. Sometimes. Sometimes he doesn't. But you have this idea of cause and effect. There's this connection between, I want my arm to go up, and my arm goes up. And he says that's a kind of cause and effect, but it's not material causation, it's mental causation. It's an interaction between your mind and its intention, and then the response that God gives to it in the forms of the ideas he gives you. Yeah.
So with that, if you would take a paraplegic into consideration, does that mean that their connection to God is just no longer in existence? Like because they can't will their limbs to move, or they can't will something within matter to happen, their connection to God is not existent?
What would you say about a paraplegic in the material world if you believe in God? Would that be a different question? I mean, you can ask the question, well, why did God make this person with a genetic defect such that they're a paraplegic? Suppose they had like some kind of birth defect or a degenerative neurological disease. I mean, isn't the question sort of like, isn't that seem unfair?
Well, I mean, even if it was like caused by an accident, like someone broke their neck or something like that, and they've been like they don't have the ability to move their limbs any longer. Like once they were able to, but now they're not. Does that restrict their communication with God to a point where it's?
Well, God's still communicating with them. It's just that He's sending different responses than you would get. So you want to move your arm and your arm goes up. Somebody who's paralyzed moves their arm and it doesn't go up. Why does it not go up? Well, God set up this world with certain regularities, so we do know that certain things we should do and certain things we should not do. Jumping into a lake of unknown depth from a high rock is something you shouldn't do, right? Or you end up getting paralyzed. So he would say that it's not that the person's not communicating with God, it's just that they're getting a different set of ideas than they want and that somebody else would have. Right? And then we get different ideas. If we look at like an X-ray, we see, their spinal column is all, compressed or something. And then that's associated that the spinal column being compressed or fractured or what have you is associated with them not being able to move their limbs. So it's if you think about Barclay, it's like you just take the material world picture and then you say, but it's just all the sensations we think are caused by the material world, except that there's no material world causing them. It's God sending the ideas direct. And so Barclay did a lot of scientific work. He did work in optics. And so it wasn't as if he said, there's no laws of nature and there's no such thing as a prism that bends light and it's all just ideas, so it doesn't matter. He was really caught up in the details about how we get our perceptions and how perception works, even about the way the human eye works. It's just that he doesn't say, and there's a material world which is causing all these sensations. He just says that God created a world of sensation and that we all live in. But it's not a material world. Again, it has a rabid empiricist. So as an empiricist, how are you going to prove there's a material world? If the material world is by definition that which lies underneath our perceptions. Both Barclay and Hume would agree you can't do it. And that's why they fault Locke for not being a real empiricist. They say, okay, Locke, you say that you believe knowledge comes to the senses, but you have all these a priori ideas of a material world which is separate from our sensation. Where is your proof for it? What set of sensations shows that there is such a thing? And Locke can't point to anything. Right? Through Hylas in the dialogue here, Hylas can't point to anything to show that we have direct experience in the material world. He admits that it's an inference. He says, we have all these experiences, and then we can't wrap our minds around the idea that there's the experiences without something that's causing them. And so we end up with this sort of big question mark. That's the cause of our experiences. So, and we call that the material world. So coming down to Hume, what does Hume believe in?
Ideas.
Ideas, that's it. Ideas only. There's no mind. There's no cause and effect. There's no material world. And there's no God. So it's just ideas and their relationships. And it's not a causal relationship. It's just he calls it the association of ideas, which is just that you have this constant conjunction of ideas such that when you see one idea, when you experience one thing, another thing usually happens right before it or right after it. And so there's patterns, but those patterns don't necessarily show cause and effect, which is that if one thing happens, another thing has to happen. He says all you notice is that some things happen and sometimes another thing always happens, but there's no guarantee that that will continue to happen in the future or that it's always happened that way in the past. So let's start out with some terminology. Again, these are good test questions. So there's two kinds of perceptions. So a perception for Hume is any mental phenomena. And then there's two kinds. So what are the two kinds?
Impressions.
Impressions, right?
And ideas.
And ideas. Now, one of the things that's kind of confusing is that people like Locke uses idea the same way that Hume uses impression. Sorry, the way Hume uses perceptions. So for Locke, an idea is any mental thing. So, like, Locke talks about simple ideas, like the simple idea of greenness. He's talking about everything ranging from the abstract concept of greenness to having an experience of something green. He calls both those things ideas. Hume wants to restrict ideas to something different, which is a subcategory of what Locke means by ideas. So just keep in mind that sometimes the terminology of these philosophers isn't always the same. So for Hume, the general category of sense, of sensation is, you know, Locke calls them ideas of sensation, right? So he'd say you're looking at a red brick wall, that's an idea of redness. Hume would use the word perception for that. He would say you're having a perception of brick wall. Now he would say, what's the difference between an impression of a brick wall and the idea of a brick wall?
It's that the impression comes from the perception and the idea is what you get from that impression. Is that correct?
Yeah, ideas are copies of impressions. So
right.
Ideas are faint copies of impressions. And what are these for?
It's for knowledge. It's for the understanding of what you gain, right?
They're used for thinking. So, you know, you remember things, you chain together a bunch of ideas. So if you use ideas in thinking, what are they copies of? They're copies of the impressions. What are the impressions?
From your perception.
Well, impressions are a kind of perception, but what is an impression?
A lively perception.
Yeah, so it's a perception, just like an idea is, but it's a lively, vivid, sharp, clear perception. So where do these come from?
From the experience?
That just means you're having an experience. What do you mean by it from the experience? What do you mean?
Like
experience of what?
Of whatever's going on. Or like the...
Like I'm having a... suppose I'm having an impression of a red brick wall. What's going to cause that? It's not an idea. I'm not thinking about the concept of a red brick wall. I'm not saying like I hit a brick wall, you know, in my research today on anarcho-capitalism or something.
It's from your senses. Is that what you're trying to get at?
Well, you're standing in front of it. Now that's what a normal person would say, right? Or a person who's not a philosopher. What does Hume say about it? Where do the impressions come from?
From recall of memory.
Where do the memories come from? Because those are just memories are just ideas, right? So these are
includes memories
and also imagination. Well, this is kind of a trick question. Hume says we don't know. Now, somebody like Locke would say, oh, the difference between an impression of a brick wall and an idea of a brick wall is you're looking at the brick wall with your own eyes, and then you're like back in your study later, you're thinking about the brick wall. What Hume says is that the only difference is in your experience is this is the lively, sharp one. When you're actually looking at the brick wall, like I'm looking at that brick wall in the back of the classroom, I can see like the color of the grout. It's sort of like a grimy green color. I notice that it's not like bright red. It's kind of like a dull red. I can see that there's both dark sort of brownish bricks, and there's more kind of reddish, like maroon type bricks. Right? I can see all the details. If I'm sitting, and I could like even guesstimate the size, but if I'm sitting back in my office, I'm trying to think about that brick wall, it's kind of hazy. I can't like count the bricks. Right? It's not as clear in my mind. It's because it's a faint copy. Yeah.
Is the difference between an impression and an idea to them more based on the force of effort put into visualizing the same? I mean, if you're just kind of thinking about a wall, it may be red, it may be brick, or maybe whatever, that's kind of an idea, whereas an impression is you're specifically intending to think about a wall that has specific features. Yeah. Engine-driven kind of...
That's one of the key parts of the distinction, too. And another way of saying that is the impressions. Impressions are passive, whereas ideas are active. So you don't have to expend any effort to have an impression of the brick wall. You just look at the brick wall, there it is, right? You don't have to try too hard to visualize it. It's just it forces itself on you. And you can't like not see the brick wall if you're looking at it. Whereas if you're trying to think of the brick wall later, it takes some, as you say, some effort to think about the brick wall. You have to form an intention to call it to mind and to visualize it. And so it's something that you do as opposed to something that happens to you. So the sensation, the perceptions that we call impressions are something that happen to us, whereas the active ones, the ideas, are something we do. You have control over whether you remember something. I mean, I suppose not always, right? But when you do remember something or call it to mind, you're bringing back some... you're making a copy of a past impression. It's something that you're doing. When you're imagining something, like when you're thinking of and trying to imagine a pink elephant or something like that, something that you do. It's not something that happens to you. So it requires some initiative on your part. Whereas sensation is something that just happens to you, right? You walk outside and you feel it's cold and you see the trees, and that's all stuff that happens to you passively without you having to spend any effort. Yeah?
I haven't read all of Hume yet, but I'm wondering if I'm misinterpreting this. Since he only believes in ideas, I mean, how is that empiricism when, I mean, he doesn't believe in the material world, I'm saying? Is what I mean?
Yeah. How is that empiricism? Okay, well, if it this way. So, you're having certain experiences right now, right? So how are you experiencing the world? Well, how many senses do you have?
Right.
Okay. So then Hume would say, actually, you might borrow a line from Berkeley: "Material substratum, call you it. Pray, by which of your senses came you to be acquainted by that being?" In other words, which of your senses tells you there's a material world?
Right.
And so. And then, you know, Hylas says, well, it's not any one sensation. It's like we have all these sensations, and then we say, well, there's got to be something causing them. And Berkeley says, well, of course, God's causing them. Hume says, well, we know we have all these sensations, or Hume would use the word perceptions, and we don't know where they come from, and maybe we never will. We don't know they came from God. We don't know they came from the material world. All we know is that we have them, and they seem related in certain ways. And that's sort of the end of the story. So again, the kind of ultimate skeptic. But Hume would say he's not being a skeptic for skepticism's sake. It's just that he requires proof in order to have a positive belief in something. And he says you can't, if you're going to be an empiricist, you can't prove a material world exists. with non-empirical principle or with empirical principles. You have to jump over the rationalist camp and try to cook up some a priori reasoning. And Hume has an interesting point here. He says, and this goes back to this a priori and a posteriori, which I noticed that more people than should have missed it on the test, maybe because I didn't focus on it in class. This is actually important in understanding Hume. And so what the a priori means, again, independent of the senses, and a posteriori means dependent on them, dependent on the senses. And so Hume says that a priori reasoning can only tell you how certain ideas are related to one another. It can only tell you how ideas are related. Concepts. How concepts are related to other concepts. Whereas a posteriori reasoning tells you about what exists. So you can never prove that something exists a priori, because all it does is tell you about concepts. Like if I say, what is a unicorn? A unicorn is a horse with a horn on it. And what else about the concept of the unicorn? It can only be ridden by a virgin. And what else? It has magical powers and is associated with rainbows, right? So that's what I say, the concept of the unicorn. Hume would say, how would you know whether or not unicorns exist? He would say you'd have to do an investigation where you'd go to a bunch of zoos, see if they have any unicorns, maybe investigate reports of unicorns in the countryside. You have to do something to see, has anyone ever seen a unicorn? If there's pictures of the unicorn, did they come from superstitious eras? Were the witnesses reliable? And so on. And he would say, if you can't get any empirical proof of unicorns, they don't exist. But to find out whether a unicorn exists, you can't just think about the concept of a unicorn. Now, sometimes I think Hume might say, if you come up with an actual contradiction, maybe you can dismiss the idea of a unicorn. But he would say there's nothing contradictory in a unicorn. In the same way as if Hume might say, you can know there's no such thing as a circular cube or something, right? Because they are a spherical cube. Because being spherical and being a cube are contrary properties. Okay, so you could rule that out. But to prove there's no unicorns, you'd have to do an investigation with your senses. Because matters of fact and existence have to do with empirical proof, proof with regard to the senses. A priori reasoning, again, only tells you about concepts and how some concepts are related to other concepts. Yeah?
But if he doesn't believe in a material world nor God, if God's not giving certain things properties, for instance, say if I gave him hot sauce and never told him what it was and he drank it, how would he know that if he doesn't have the idea of it being hot sauce before he tasted it?
Yeah, he would say, the hot sauce, he would say that, in our experience, the experience of drinking, hot sauce is followed by certain sensations of burning, say. And that what happens is that, let's see. One thing you might say is that, we know certain sets of sensory experiences seem related. So every time somebody, has something which comes from a certain kind of pepper, they get this burning sensation. And so we say that some chemical in the pepper causes the burning sensation.
Right.
But he would say all we know really is that, one set of impressions is followed by another set of impressions. That every time you have something made from this plant, it burns your palate. But that doesn't mean that causes the burning of the palate. It just means that this thing happens and that thing happens. So in other words, and this gets, maybe we'll get to talk about cause and effect in a second here. But as far as like where the impressions come from, he would say, well, you know, we don't know. If you can't prove God exists, you can't prove the material world exists, all you can say is we have these impressions. And nobody knows where they come from. And there's no way of getting outside of our sensations and saying, okay, there's the sensations, let's look at what they're coming from. Because there's no way to jump out of your skin and have like a God's eye point of view and say, oh, there's the world, there's our sensations, and this is how they're all related. We're stuck in this world of sensations. And so that's why there's this, that's why he says you can't know the world exists. And if you can't know the world exists, that's the same as saying it doesn't exist. So you can only make a claim to knowledge if you have some proof. And again, if you can't prove it with regard to the senses, you have to say it doesn't exist. Just like the unicorn, right? Unicorns don't exist. Why? Because there's no evidence for them. Impressions are the lively, vivid ones. Ideas are the faint copies of impressions used in thinking. Impressions. Locke says the material world is causing our impressions. Berkeley says it's God, and Hume. Who knows?
Exactly.
Right.
I think that, if I may, like, being that skeptical, I might as well not believe in anything, because, like, I can't prove that Henry VIII existed, yet I've learned about him, or Abraham Lincoln, or anybody else back in the past, so it's almost pointless to even think that you know anything. All you can do is prove it through the senses.
Hmm. That's a good question about, like, you know, how far do you take the skepticism? I think Hume would say, like, you know Henry VIII exists because you've seen a picture of him, and people, like, have written all these accounts, like official, you know, court historians, and you have experience with court historians, and they tend to, even if they might sort of color things a little bit, they tend to write things that are reliable about what's going on today, and so there's no reason to suppose that they didn't do that in the past. Although, you might get into trouble with his views on cause and effect, this idea that the patterns in the past have always been the same as patterns in the future. So yeah, maybe you have a point there. But I think Hume would probably try to say that you have experience with testimony, and so that's something that you can sort of say testimony can be reliable or unreliable, and if you have experience with chroniclers and you say they're usually reliable, then maybe you could say that the people who wrote about Henry VIII and painted pictures and so on are probably reliable. But you don't have any experience with the material world because nobody's ever seen it.
Right. You can't prove it, as he said. You know.
Yeah.
It's dependent on the senses. Like, you have to be that a posteriori type thought.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I've never seen Henry, I've never touched him, I've never smelt him, whatever you want to say. Like, I can't prove that he exists if I was going with Hume's ideas, right?
Existed. It proves he existed. Yeah, I suppose, I mean, if you mean like a material Henry VIII, well then no, there's no material world. Yeah. But I think he would say like this idea of, if you again think about Henry VIII as being like a compilation of sense data, well then, why not, right?
Right, that's what I think. Like, I mean, I believe that Henry VIII existed, but I couldn't prove it other than through books, I guess. But
well, yeah, sure you could prove it, right? You have some history books, and you have pictures of him, paintings.
Right.
you have like you have an institution of chroniclers in the government that record all these things. You can go down there and watch the chroniclers recording things, and you say, okay, so this is how the government records things. And you look and you like sit in court all day, and then you like read the chroniclers' report of what went on. And you're like, oh, that's pretty much what went on,
right?
Do they ever get the name of the king wrong? Do they ever change the name of the king just for fun? No, it didn't seem to happen.
Right.
Could have happened, well, maybe, but probably not. Yeah, so I think that, so in that way, I mean, if you have Hume's view, you don't necessarily have to be that skeptical.
Don't they do that with God, though? They're like books and it's in governments and everything.
Well, that's really an interesting point, because later on we're going to look at Hume's essay of miracles, where he talks about religious knowledge and actually says a lot of skeptical things about testimony. and basically says, even if you read reports of miracles, you shouldn't believe in any of them.
Right.
So, yeah, I see what you mean. It might end up that Hume's too skeptical for his own good. But I'm just saying that you could not believe in the material world and still, you know, believe Henry VIII existed. Or you could still think, well, you could have Barclay's view, and I think on Barclay's view, you could believe Henry VIII existed. Hume's view on cause and effect is really, you know, makes it really difficult. And we'll see actually later on that in his essay on miracles, he has to sort of repudiate his view on cause and effect to make his argument. But that'll come later. That'll be on the, I think that's not until the third exam. I want to mention too, I'll have some kind of extra credit assignment if you didn't do well on the first exam. I did add a 5-point curve, so if you look at your grades, whatever it says there, if you click on grades in Moodle, is your adjusted score. So it's 5 points from what you... I think it should be 5 points from what you saw in the computer lab. I think I had 4 from last year, and then I like just bumped it up 1 because I looked at the distribution and that seemed good. And that gave me about a third of the class ended up getting A's on that, 40-some-odd% B's. So fairly generous curve. Let's see what else. And then, I'll have some extra credit assignment. I'm talking to the testing lab about doing a comprehensive final. they're kind of balking at the idea of another exam in finals week where things are jam-packed. So I might have it available early, like in week 10.
So when you say comprehensive final?
It'll be drawn on questions from all three of the exams. So... I might end up having to have that available in week 10, and then the final, the third test, just be during final exam week. Because otherwise, you know, people tend to wait to the last minute in the finals, and then if everybody shows up around Thursday to take 2 tests, it might be tough. Another solution we talked about was having you do both tests on the same test, so you basically, if you wanted to answer the comprehensive final questions, it'd be another section of the test. Still working out the details. I should know by Wednesday. But I just wanted to let you know about the curve and that I'll have some extra credit assignment. In the past, I've had a paper, but my schedule this term, I've had some new committees I'm on, other stuff going on. I don't think I'll have time to grade those extra credit papers this term, so I'm going to try to go with another test. Yeah?
Is there an opportunity or an ability for us to look at answers on the previous test and see which ones are right and wrong?
Oh, yes. So currently, you'll have to come by my office to do that. And I can call them up on my big screen monitor, and we can go over them point by point. And so I think that's the way we have to do it now, because for some reason, the Moodle system, if I allow you to see your test in the lab, there's no way to keep you from looking at home and copying and passing around. Even though I changed questions from term to term, a person would have an unfair advantage if they got a test from somebody else. So test security being what it is, and the Moodle system being not being flexible enough, that's the way it's going to have to be for now. I'm going to talk to the lab about seeing if they can fix that this term too, but that doesn't look very good at this moment. Okay, but so for the time being, just come by my office so we can go over the test. It's also, I think, handy for to have me there looking over your shoulder explaining why the answer you chose is not the right one and why it should be some other answer. Kind of out of room. Let me take a couple pictures of the board before I erase it. One of these days I'm going to get my iPad set up. Turns out the iPad 1 that I got, it doesn't cooperate with the projection system. I got to have the iPad 2 for that. I might end up jury rigging something. And this is in the again, if you're looking for the board notes, you missed class, there's all the podcasts are always there, and they're in the top block in Moodle and in the forum. And so if you ever miss class, you can catch up. And I stick my board notes up there too. The human cause and effect. So, why does a human believe in cause and effect?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. What's Hume's argument? Look at it this way. What's Hume's argument against cause and effect? Or maybe try one more time. Try one more question. That's maybe a better question. What is cause and effect? We say X, one thing cause another, what does that mean?
There's something that has to cause it.
Okay, so you have a cause and effect. So there's one thing has to.
One thing happens for there to be a reaction of it.
It's a one-way flow.
Cause and effect. So, I mean, what is, like, when you think about the concept of cause and effect, what? Uh-huh. So you throw a pebble into a pond, and you get the water ripples out. Right? So what's the cause?
Going the water. Yeah, right.
The rock hitting the water. And then the effect?
The rippling.
It is rippling, right? So, when you look at cause and effect, when you say that the rock caused the rippling in the pond, like, what does that mean?
It's a time-related, one-way stream of actions.
The cause is prior to the effect? The cause always has to come before the effect. So you never see, like, the pond ripples and then a stone goes into it, right? Or if you never see your window shatters and then a baseball hits it. So it's always the baseball hits the window and then it shatters. So, and Hume says, look, one thing about cause and effect is the cause always has to come before the effect. Seems common sense. Priority in time. This might be a little controversial for you science nerds, but Hume says that what if you threw the rock and it didn't skip in the pond, but it sort of landed in the mud on the other side? Would there be a ripple?
Maybe.
It just goes plop into the mud. Probably not, right? So you take the rock, kind of skip it, right? And it goes into some weeds off the side. There's no ripple. Why? Because the rock didn't touch the pond. And so the other thing Hume says is it's the objects they got to touch, right? So, and he calls this contiguity. Objects must touch. So if you have, like, you're playing billiards, right? And you got your, you're knocking one billiard ball with a cue stick, and you're trying to hit the other billiard ball sitting here. And if it misses it, it just keeps on going off. You don't hear a clacking sound. This one doesn't move at all. Nothing happens, right? It's only when you have a collision of the two billiard balls that it's going to go off in some direction. So you have the objects have to touch. But is that, you know, is that enough? There's a, Hume says there's a third part of cause and effect, which is like the really, maybe the really important part of cause and effect. Do you ever see these two things? And sometimes, suppose I'm in the lunchroom and I'm just finishing up my lunch, and a colleague comes up and puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "How's it going?" And suddenly I feel a sharp pain on my stomach. Right? Now, what would be your normal response to that? Yeah.
You have to be able to show causality.
Yeah, well, we're talking about causality, right? So the question is, what's missing there? And like, you normally, or suppose, I would normally think, you know, I feel a sharp pain in my stomach, and the person puts his hand on my shoulder, and it happens right afterwards. I wouldn't say, oh no, you know, I would say, get your hand off my shoulder, it's causing me great pain in my stomach. I would think maybe it's the cafeteria food, right? I wouldn't think that the hand, even though it happened right beforehand, I wouldn't think that that happened. What's another example of like false cause where one thing happens and then nothing happens and you don't connect those in your mind? Well, like if you're talking about a friend, right? And then the friend like sort of comes around the corner and you say something like "speak of the devil" or whatever, but you don't think automatically that your conversation brought him around the corner. You get just a coincidence. Or what's another example of a coincidence where nobody would make a connection? A correlation without causation. Like a really easy one. And I'm drawing a blank here now.
Kind of like that scene in a movie where the guy is walking home and he's like, can't get any worse, and then it starts raining. Like it's not his cause. He didn't cause it by saying it's raining.
Yeah, right?
Me for sure.
Sure, yeah. So you're having a really bad day, and you're like, this day sucks. It can't get any worse. And then it starts raining on you. You know, most people don't think that that they're you know, saying it can't get any worse cause it to start raining. But superstitious beliefs in general, the sort of idea is that if you walk under a ladder, it's bad luck, or if you step on a sidewalk crack or what have you, that it's going to cause bad things to happen to you. Most people realize that that's really, that there isn't anything to that, that it's sort of an irrational connection between one thing and another. And, you know, it makes sense that at some time somebody stepped on a crack in the sidewalk, maybe they tripped on it and fell. And so you think, oh, okay, well, don't step on those sidewalk cracks because they're dangerous. So there's something missing here, and it's the and I like that you said the causality, which makes it really seem like it's the whole ball of wax, or most of it. These two things are part of it. But the big thing is that it's the kind of the mustness of causation. Necessity. Which is the idea that if A happens, then B must happen. It can't not happen. That if that brick hits my fragile window, it's going to shatter. If this billiard ball goes towards this other billiard ball with sufficient speed, it's going to make a clacking noise, and the billiard ball is going to go off in some direction. And, you know, if it hits it square on, it's going to go straight. If it hits it on the right, it's going to go left. If it's on the left, it's going to go right. And there's some, you know, there's also some causation involved in like what exactly the angle is. And so you don't think, oh, it's not just that it's going to happen, but it has to happen. And that's the idea of causation, that if A happens, B has to happen. And this isn't the case with correlation, right? Like, so I don't think, you know, if I say my friend's name and he comes around the corner, I don't think that's causally related, because later I've used his names lots of other times and he hasn't come around the corner. And I'm talking smack about my friend all the time, and it just this is the first time that he came around and heard what I was saying about him behind his back. So so there's no causation there in my mind, because there's no constant conjunction of objects such that if the one thing happens, the other thing's always there. So now Hume says, as good empiricists, we're going to figure out, is there such a thing as cause and effect? So let's go down the line. If you try to verify cause and effect with the senses, which of these can you verify? So is it the case in our experience that every time that the cause always comes before the effect, the priority time? Okay. Yeah, that seems pretty good. How about the idea that objects have to touch? So like if I'm going to cut my hands, right? They touch and it makes a sound. If I go like that, it's not making any sound. I suppose maybe it's sort of a whooshing sound, maybe. But it's like, if I want to make a clapping sound, my hands have to touch to make that clapping sound. I don't want to get into the minutia, but you know, you could say, well, what about gravity, and what about causation at a distance, and some wiseacre is going to bring up, back. Actually, some wiseacre usually brings up backward causation with regard to quantum mechanics and stuff, and all sorts of weird stuff. Let's leave all the weird physics stuff aside.
I can agree with it.
Yes, it must
happen. I mean, like, the only example I could think of at first was not touching is, like, if I said something really rude to you, but then again, when I talk, my sound waves are hitting your eardrums, so...
Right. Well, like gravity, so if gravity is a warp in the four-dimensional time-space field, then it's still, you're getting, if you think about space isn't really a medium. You get into all these weird paradoxes, and although there's some theories that there are things like gravitons, that there are actually particles involved in gravity. So leaving that aside, most common sense everyday examples, you think, yeah, you see the objects touch, and we're good there. But what about this third one, the necessity? Can you see necessity?
No. Not always.
Not always? How about ever? Or what's an example where you would see necessity?
When the sun comes up, it gets bright outside.
Okay. So how do you know the sun's going to rise tomorrow?
Well,
it has in the past?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always risen in the past. But then the question, yeah.
One good necessity is the obvious fact that every human being's body will eventually die.
I don't know about that. We're doing a lot of the research in anti-aging medicine right now.
That's true.
But all men are mortal is an old philosophical example.
So far.
Yeah, but maybe there might be some people in this classroom that might end up being immortal. I want to come back to the sun rising for a second, though. So Hume actually uses this example. How do you know the sun's going to rise tomorrow? And what would you say? How would you know? Why do you think the sun's going to rise tomorrow?
Because it has to pass.
Yeah, always has in the past, right? Every day there's the sun over and over again, right? And Hume says, but does that show the sun has to rise? Or is it just told you this? In other words, because it's always worked that way in the past, how do you know that pattern's going to continue in the future?
Well, if it didn't, wouldn't there be an effect, different gravity, if the sun was going to rise again? And everything would change if the sun was going to rise, right?
Uh,
gravity on Earth?
Well, but then what is gravity? Gravity is just a description of the... Can you stop that clicking, please? Gravity is just a description of the regularities that we observe, right? We observe certain regularities, and then we quantify them, and then we draw these equations, like Kepler's, you know, laws or Newton's laws about gravitational attraction, that it follows an inverse square law, and you can describe it. But those are just like long, detailed descriptions of what we experience. There's no mustness in gravitation. I mean, you can call it a law, but what is a law of nature? Just the way things have happened so far. It's just a generalization about the experiences we've had so far. But how do we know those patterns are going to continue in the future? And Hume thinks about this being sort of like Pavlov's dog, right? So you have Pavlov, the pioneer in operant conditioning. He would ring a bell, and then he'd feed the dog food. He'd ring a bell and feed the dog. He'd ring the bell, feed the dog. Over and over again, bell, food, bell, food, bell, food. Pretty soon he'd ring the bell, and the dog would come running, and he'd look around, and the dog would actually be salivating in anticipation of that food coming. And then one day, he didn't bring the food, right? And the dog's in there expecting the food. Where's the food? And it doesn't come. So the question is, how do we know that one day we're going to expect some result and it's not going to happen? What is the mustness in that dog drew a causal connection between the bell ringing and the food coming? Where did that causal connection exist?
The past.
Well, the dog noticed the past constant conjunction of events, right? Bell, food, bell, food, bell, food. What's that?
Recurrence.
Yeah, it was recurrence, right? And you remembered, okay, everyone, I've seen the bell, and here comes the food.
Perception of what happened?
It's in his, but his present perception? But what I'm trying to elicit here is it's all in the dog's mind, right? He has this expectation that the food's going to come, but it's not out there in the world. And Hume, in the same way, says the necessity of cause and effect is not something you can observe. So it's not observable. Mm-hmm. It's all in your mind. It's a natural, but I don't know if you'd say irrational, but it's a natural but unprovable expectation and psychological expectation. So you have the psychological expectation that when you see the cause, the effect's going to come. Oh, there's a brick hurtling towards my window. Oh no, plate glass or whatever, right? Or it's they got the newfangled glass, maybe it's just going to make a dent. Right? But if it's a big enough brick and it's thrown hard enough, it's going to come through the wall. And you think, oh, brick, heavy, hard brick going really fast through a fragile window, it's going to break, it's going to make a certain sound, and so on. That's an expectation that you have, and you really can't escape it. But Hume says that doesn't prove that it's going to happen that way. All you just have this expectation that it's going to happen that way because of all your past experience. But past experience is no guarantee of future results, as they say in all the investment commercials. Right? So in the same way, just because things have always happened that way in the past doesn't mean they're going to happen in the future. So in order to know that in order to observe the necessity, you would have to know patterns in the past must continue into the future. And Hume would say, what sensation or set of sensations proves this. In other words, what experiences can you point to that shows that that's the case? It's always happened that way before. You can think of like cases like this in your own life where like there's been something that's always worked before and then until it doesn't, until something happens. Yeah. My car's always been reliable before and then it breaks down.
Well, what about something so basic as like clapping your hands? When would it not make a sound when you don't have another hand to clap it against?
Yeah, I think he would say you expect it to make a sound, but there's no logical necessity. And so he would say, you know, necessity. What is necessity? Necessity is logical necessity. Which means the contrary or the opposite contains no contradiction. So when you say X is necessary, you mean the opposite has no contradiction. So if I say, I don't know, 2 + 2 = 5. If I say a triangle has 3 sides. Hume would say this is a necessary truth. Because the opposite, a triangle has 4 sides, is a contradiction. Or take an easy one, A equals A is a necessary truth.
And so it would be considered a truth instead of a cause and effect? Or how would he define that?
Well, he would say the necessity is something like with regard to objects, it's just that if one thing happens, the other thing has to happen. And this idea of having to happen means that it's impossible for it not to happen. So if you say the brick caused the window to break, what you mean is that it's logically impossible that the brick hits the window and it doesn't break. But you can imagine all sorts of other things happening, right? You can imagine the brick bouncing off the window like a rubber ball. You can imagine the brick disappearing. You can imagine the brick going right through the window. Like, you can picture in your mind all these different things. But you just expect that it's not going to happen. But if you can imagine something different happening, then it's not necessary. You can't imagine a triangle with 4 sides. That shows it's a necessary truth. That it's logically impossible for there to be a 4-sided triangle. You can imagine a thing not being equal to itself. That shows you this is a necessary truth, and it's impossible for a thing to be the opposite of itself. It's impossible for a contradiction to be true. But in your mind, you can picture all sorts of things that violate the laws of nature. You can picture Superman flying through the air. You can picture unicorns with magical powers. You can imagine all kinds of things, which are contrary to the laws of nature, and so that shows there's no necessity in the laws of nature because you can imagine the opposite. If you can imagine something, that shows that it's possible. Now, does that mean that you expect it to happen? No, but it shows that it's possible. So, yeah, I can imagine a unicorn, which shows that unicorns are possible. Doesn't mean they exist, but it means that there could be a unicorn. But there could also be, you know, a brick that goes right through a window and doesn't break it when the window's closed. So it's kind of a subtle point. He thinks that when you say possible means logically possible. Possible means that it might or might not happen. Whereas necessary means it must happen. And that's the difference there. Oh, we're out of time. So that's it for now. More on Hume's theory about the mind on Wednesday.